my last year in Bethel, you have a surprise for the next year, and so I'm going to have a surprise. My forgiveness, and we have had some of that. Justice Robert Rose, this is the very first time from the High Court of Appeals that we've had another judge appointed to serve on a particular case. The judge had no power to voluntarily refuse himself in this case here, and Justice Rose accepted the appointment. Some of you know Justice Rose, but not all of you do. We feel we're very lucky to have him here today to assist us on this case and to make the decision. Justice Rose has a long and distinguished career in the state of Nevada, and I think I'd be remiss if I didn't advise all of you a little bit about that. He graduated from law school on the 100th anniversary of Nevada's admission to the Union of Carolina. From New York, and Europe, and then came to Nevada and worked in private practice, and then he later elected the district attorney in Washoe County in Reno, and served in that capacity, and he was elected lieutenant governor, and one of the jobs as lieutenant governor in the state. But that was serving as president of the state senate in the late 70s. Some of you might recall there was a very big issue circulating among the states, the Equal Rights Amendment. And it was presented to Nevada for passage, and we were one of the final states, the last state to approve it. And Justice Rose, then, as lieutenant governor and president of the senate, cast the deciding vote in the senate. Where then went to the assembly and what happened there.
That legally.
So that was a very memorable time. He was back in the private practice after serving as lieutenant governor, and then went to the district court bench here in Trent County. As Chief Justice. And while on the Supreme Court, he also helped out to Clark County and Justice Sullivan.
I was his law clerk from
Lincoln
1989. So to be sitting here at the same bench as him is just amazing.
I testimony to your great work and my longevity.
After all those years in the judiciary, you retire, but do judges ever really retire? Some do, but then many do not, and Justice Rose went on and became very active in various court improvement areas and alternative dispute resolution. And he became the recipient, the very first recipient, by the way, of the award presented by the Boyd Law School. And that particular award, Legacy of Justice Award for Exceptional Dedication to Law in New York, 2013. So, those of you that are here might not remember that, but most of the analysts, and if that was how that came about, but that was pretty exciting, and Justice Rose has been very active in ADR. It's something for all students to remember. The vast majority of cases are settled. Getting skills in settlement negotiation, alternative dispute resolution is really important because you'll put that to use in practice no matter what you do. So Justice Rose is continuing on in that particular area and also serves as a senior justice. So, a long-winded explanation there, but again, we feel very blessed to have Justice Rose assisting us today. Our next case is ready to be heard at this time. It's case number 66-D90, GB versus Ramadan. This is a family law case. And we also have pro bono counsel appointed by the Supreme Court to represent the respondent, Ms. Ramadan. So when there's a pro bono appointment on an appellate case, what that means is what, Mrs. Silver?
Yeah, I'm not.
the same reason for any of you to consider Buffalo work and repeating through practicing attorneys that are close with the various clinics that exist here at law school. We have Mr. Alder, you know, for the appellant, Mr. Zucchini.
Today, we respectfully request that this court reverse and remand the decisions of the district court regarding child custody, property distribution, child support and alimony, and attorney's fees. Now, it's no secret, Your Honors, that there were some serious allegations levied against Pierce in this case. And we certainly appreciate how serious those allegations were.
Mr. Walter, I'm sorry to interrupt. Maybe the time we do have a photographer here from the RJ attorney in objection.
Despite the seriousness of the allegations levied against Pierce in this case, Pierce is still entitled to a fair hearing. And as we will demonstrate today, because Pierce was denied a fair hearing in nearly every aspect of this case, the district court's decisions must be reversed. I'll start with the most important issue, child custody. Here, the district court erred by ruling not a sole legal and physical custody of the children, because the district court relied on Pierce's inadmissible voluntary pleas in determining the best interests of the children. NRS 48.125 and NRS 51.295 both expressly rendered voluntary pleas inadmissible in subsequent civil actions. Now, despite the fact that voluntary pleas are inadmissible under Nevada law, the district court's final order states expressly and repeatedly that the district court is relying on Pierce's voluntary pleas in rendering a custody decision. Your Honor, it is legal error for the district court to rely on this inadmissible evidence.
Even if we accept that argument as true, there is legal error and it's clearly within the order itself. That order also goes on for pages and pages of various incidents of abuse throughout the 8-year marriage. Not just the one incident, but 8 years of marriage. And this particular judge stated on the record that in 15 years from marriage and family court, this is one of the top 5 worst cases of domestic abuse she had seen. So why isn't this harmless error based on all the other aspects of domestic violence?
Your Honor, while there was other evidence of domestic violence, as well as just testimony from Nevada and Nevada's mother, the district court's heavy reliance on the inadmissible voluntary pleas almost certainly tainted the way the district court gave that other evidence. The district court almost certainly gave Nevada's testimony for a week, because it was corroborated by the inadmissible voluntary pleas. And the district court almost certainly gave Pierce's testimony, and Pierce's father's testimony that he did not commit domestic violence last week, because it was contradicted by the inadmissible voluntary pleas. Given how heavily the district court relied on the inadmissible voluntary pleas in the final order, it's at least reasonable to conclude that the court's decision may have been different if the court had not relied on its inadmissible evidence. And because the court's decision might have been different, this is not harmless error. Whereas this is not a situation where a piece of inadmissible evidence did marry a bench trial and was never discussed again. In those cases, we can assume that the district court simply disregarded the inadmissible evidence. That's harmless error. But that's not what happened here. The court may expressly rely on that evidence over and over and over in rendering a decision. Now, like the Georgia court of the IGCC section concluded, if this court's consideration of inadmissible evidence cannot be viewed as harmless when the final order relies heavily on that evidence in rendering a decision.
This was the original
officer of the club. He did not play a significant role in the district court's ultimate policy decision. The district court spent so much time discussing the local entry to the final order. In other words, the clubs have a great evidence of domestic violence. Why do you mention his name this way? I say, not only mention it, but say explicitly that you're using it as a conclusive evidence, very convincing evidence of domestic violence. One thing you're not allowed to use the local entry case for. But because of this report, I also have an understanding this for all of the entry case laws. This was not a bonus error. The district court's policy decision must be reversed and remanded for a new evidentiary hearing. My pursuit of other evidence does not seem to be one of the cases inadmissible of all of the entry case.
The district court did go through all the factors
from the ISO 25.48 subsection 4, but it's clear from the district court's final order that its main consideration was the inadmissible, domestic violence, which was supported by the inadmissible local contender case. On remand, the court doesn't consider the local contender case closely relevant, but because the district court committed a legal error and used the local contender case in its ultimate decision, it has to be remanded so the court can do the evidentiary hearing, consider all the other factors, minus the local contender case, and determine what's in the best interest of the
court. That is also that the case perhaps were going to be set aside and not even result in convictions. Do you know what actually happened on that or what else presented to the court?
There's been a little discussion about the local contender case. Really, all the time they're discussing is the final order with the district court says, and in many cases, I'm using them as an inclusive proof of domestic violence occurring in this case.
So, I realize that you aren't the attorney your client had failed to attach his defense to his objection to the child support hearing officer's recommendation to show that a modification was warranted. So, why would a district court allow to affirm that order? It's up to your client to attach the defense to show a change in circumstance. And then also, I noticed in the final decree that the district court mentioned that even if it had taken your client's argument and accepted that it's true, that it still didn't warrant modification. So how did the district court hear?
That's what I was about to tell you about. That's what I was about to tell you
about. I moved on to something else.
So the error with modification now is a procedural error. This is what the factual guidelines is a little confusing. At the beginning of the trial, the district court ordered hearings to be child support and alimony pending final resolution of divorce. But before the final order was handed down, the district court moved everything related to collection of the child support alimony to a brand new case number. The multi-bar case. So we have two cases. We have the divorce case, which is the case before this order, and the R case, which has to do with collection of the child support alimony. So if there's not a motion for modification of child support alimony in the R case, the hearing was held before a hearing officer in the R case and recommended that this motion be denied, and there's not an objection in the R case. Is that following proper procedure and holding a hearing in the R case and ruling on fears?
You don't have to have a hearing, though. In other words, you don't have to have a hearing. That's what the record you're looking at.
Because the district court sees in the final order that it was confused about what the hearing officer did, they should have held a hearing. Even if it didn't hold a hearing, they decided to rule on Pierce's objection in the R case. What the district court did was deny Pierce's objection in the final order filed in the D case. So what the district court did was split up the final appealable order and the entire record related to that order across two separate district court cases. So now that we're talking about appeal, the entire case has been appealed in the case. That's what we need to do with Pierce's motion, the hearing officer's recommendation, Pierce's objection. So we have no idea what happened in the district court.
Final response to his objection saying that her client failed to attach his limits to show that if he had a decrease in income. And the DA actually, the district attorney actually filed a response saying that her client failed to link that was on there. What is the district court that says I'm hearing on that?
We don't know what happened. Nothing from the back case is in the record on appeal of the front case. We have no idea if the information about what happened in the case came from the district court's final order filed. Case, because the record that is never appealed and it can't be appealed because the district court does not have a global order in that case. So there's nothing from the record on appeal of the R case. I don't know what happened, so it was the district attorney filed things and the court verified and how the other idea that the members that are doing the file order of the new case are not doing.
And they still learn a thing on their field. So why can't your client get it? It's his case, why can't he get a sealed record?
Well, like they are, it's me, I'm the entire record on the old case. I'm saying, I'm not just recording it. On a case that hasn't been appealed and presented as a misdemeanor. So I'm inside you, and there's that case, out of bounds, and I'm free. And the court is closing it. It can't be appealed because there's no final appeal order in that case. You can't just grab the entire record from that deal presented to this court. If it doesn't court fall, federal procedure. Get a final decision in our case because appeal ballot is down in the final appeal. Because the district court is procedural error, screwed up final appeal order. And the entire record relating to that order across two district court cases, we all know what happened on appeal. Right, so the district court committed three errors in distributing federal property. First, the district court erred by setting aside and advancing the marital home with Mrs. Fowler without saying that Mrs. Fowler is a necessary party to the case. In Johnson v. Johnson, the Dallas Supreme Court held we set aside and advanced the marital property to the third party will receive the demand, not to be joined in the case as a necessary party. Failing to join the third party creates due process issues, and it could lead to multiple inconsistent orders if the third party files their own lawsuit relating to the same piece of property. Here's the nursing made in marital home to Fowler before not filed for divorce. And although that's the trial, the district court recognized that the nursing father was the better title holder of the home. Finally joining the case, and the district court actually ordered Bob's attorney to join the nurse's father to the case as a necessary party. Now, it's not order. Mrs. Fowler was never joined in the case, but the final order still sets aside the conveyance of the marital home of Mrs. Fowler, and then authorizes the Honorable County Clerk of the Court, signed the transfer of the home away from the record title holder of Mrs. Fowler, and gave it to him. She did this a few months ago. So that got this deed, but signed by the clerk of the court, the government entity, transferred a piece of real property away from Fierce's father and gave it out of name. And Fierce's father has never been appointed to this case. As the Johnson Court put it, what constitutes taking property to one person and giving it to another without a hearing?
Because it's a friendly record, and he was in Jordan and that. They tried to serve him. Yeah, I mean, it's unclear from the record.
Yes, ma'am. It's unclear from the last year's trial. There's the whole beginning of the trial is dedicated to discussing the fact that Fierce's father has to be joined in the case. I'm not sure what happened after the final order states that he's not no longer a necessary party despite the court's previous ruling because he didn't sign the deed transferring the property, but there are actual documents that were filed deeds transferring the property only if he signed with the grantor, not the grantee. So Fierce in this case, not Fierce's father. So the fact that he didn't sign the deed really doesn't hold relevant for whether or not he's a necessary party. But because Fierce's father was never joined in the case, the district court's decision related to leaving the marital home must be reversed and remanded. Yes, Your Honor, the district court here by very default against based on property issues. The government was long over the Nevada Supreme Court held that the equal disposition of community property cannot be dispensed with through default. In other words, you can't have a default against on property issues that are false. Now, it's definitely clear holding. On the second day of trial, after hearing how it testified, the district court expressly held the default against Pierce on property issues. And along with that default, the court struck his answer and counterclaim. Refused to let him bring any evidence related to the property, and he simply got to call on his facts related to the property. Now, because the district court here defaulted in direct contradiction to a few thousand rulings holding it long ago, the district court's property decisions must be reversed or remanded for an evidentiary hearing. Now, in honor of the district court error, because it's facts that have been deducted from related to the home, but aren't clearly erroneous. The court found that the marital home was not his sole and separate property because he was paid for it entirely and not his salary plus transfer funds. And the other thing is not possibly to correct because the marital home across the board is a total amount of amounts versus the new settlement.
It's presented by her counsel for trial in a trial brief that they paid $38,300 in foreclosure for. But where at trial, it's hit with a value of progress.
I'm sorry, I'm going to reserve 2 minutes of bubbles if you're going to answer the question. So, Pierce was prohibited from admitting that it is related to the property, including the declaration of value showing that the home was paid for $30,300. So, he was allowed to admit that as an exhibit because of the default. His counsel was also prohibited expressly from cross-examining on property issues. So, he was allowed to do that. It is in the record on appeal. We know that the finding cannot possibly be correct. And we want to show the records that the district court wanted to volunteered to get evidence that this is separate property. Didn't even think about this whole thing that was paid for. But yet, so I think how clear you can see that it's all a separate property. Because the actual time for a harmonious decision of the year.
As the custody, the court should affirm the district court's agreement on my client, primary the full custody, so we please provide legislation for us, and not full legal custody. The evidence in this case that he committed horrific acts of domestic violence against my client over an extended 8-year period of over 1. The trial transcript shows several over 100 pages of testimony by my client as to the various acts of domestic violence that were ongoing and really continuous over an excessive period of time. Even if Your Honor would conclude that the non-voting agreement was inadmissible, there is sufficient evidence in the court, there is sufficient findings under 125.4 of 7A to allow this court to conclude that there was no abuse of discretion and that the district court properly exercised its discretion on all of the other factors, because all the other factors are just so overwhelming. My client was a victim of domestic violence, and Mr. Yehudi has no interest or ability to care for any of these three children, two of which are special needs and one child is a very special needs child. Against Mr. Virginia Vinegar's financial things that he
work in many cases of the
trial. It's my name.
not common for anyone, so if there's 8 votes, it's really strong number of work, and it's just shows what they're doing, they know, and it's about that, it's been up a few months ago, but that's not what they're doing for other voters.
But I wonder if the board will get some of the process, and it's right on board, you know, I have to be involved. I'm going to argue that the judge should be put in the latest response to the motion, not the objection. The judge says not default, but the most people, they got what actually happened. It probably wasn't a lot of the feelings.
So I understand what it was. He's accepting the responsibility, so it was, trial has to be continued twice, because he feels so strong. I had to put out a discovery motion, because he feels so strong. And there's somebody who's actually a default, says that if you don't, not you, it's kind of a hand in hand to struck. The judge saw that that will be legitimate, and it was a purpose that I'm not going to allow you to put evidence, I'm going to allow somebody to cross-examination, that he was, he's not ready to defy a court's order and do whatever he feels like he's going to do.
And in one of our cases, death is community property, it should not be a default. So the judge should just let him present some evidence on it, and she was able to leave the room. If this guy was going to go to separate property, put it in his account, and the house was purchased, there was more than the amount of money that was put in that account, there's some sort of community property claim that he should do, so that's a type of thing that you want to make use of illegal ground.
I would argue that despite the allegations from the jury, Mr. Jimmy had the opportunity to present some evidence as to whether the house was committing or preserved property or by violence of property. The fact that by the end of the trial that he gone through 4 different attorneys and was now representing himself doesn't eliminate the burden on him to know the law as well as an attorney should be hired by. The fact that he failed to do so is not a burden that should be shifted from him to my client. That will be fundamentally unfair to her because then you're giving extra advantages to people who decided not for it, not the other time.
It's simply a presumption. Everything required for a marriage is presumed needs to be privacy without the home and all the contents of the home code for again awarded to your client.
That would be speculation as to whether it was allowed illegal because he was permitted to go into the house and do the items they required. So, to say that he was, she received everything, he received nothing, would be quite accurate from a factual standpoint, from a legal standpoint. Not that Donald Trump, he had the opportunity to say, I want X, Y, Z from the house. And don't. Now, for him to come through and put approval and say, I want something I didn't ask for at the time of trial. It's probably not fair to the message to the client.
There's a difference between asking for I want my clothes versus dividing everything that's equal and the amount of his own value. You may get more than 50% of whatever it purse for us with the extra amount. So I mean, there's a difference between wanting something and actually versus wanting the value of the toy.
It simply didn't come up for him not to bring it up if it should be a burden on the ones on him and placing them on our plan. They have this fully entitled people that you don't bring it up. They are satisfied with the personal also the information in your possession, the person also has embraced his mind. He certainly bought
it. A couple of words and I find that that's an equal distribution of the property. You know, it's not equal, I'm doing it unequal for this reason.
After the party separated, he established his own house, so he purchased his own furniture. He can offer that permission, she can ask her permission. So it's presumptively an equal division if he doesn't bring it up.
We have the issue about the child support with the chairman, Jim Summers. There's a problem here.
Actually, I know the matters because if they want to be. For the purposes of appeal, they could have requested that there's nothing secret or sealed about this. I think we'll get the case in Odyssey and review everything that's been filed.
And it isn't a case where the parent hired the district attorney as the ruling party on that case.
don't always see that too. I'm not as familiar, I'm like, obviously it's different from a judicial civil criminal versus policy thing. It's just what I see. So you can look up, you're telling me you can look up the other case and see what happened in the child support DA case.
Very, 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 very,